Welcome, everyone, to BYU Sports Nation's Juneteenth Deep Blue Special. I'm your host, Spencer Linton. Over the last few years, BYU TV has explored, discovered, and produced some inspiring and unique stories, not only from within BYU athletics, but also from other universities that BYU plays all over the country. These features are at the very heart of our Deep Blue and Big Stories series. Today, we'll focus on a handful of unforgettable stories we've been honored to tell from within the African-American community. These stories teach us about overcoming adversity through faith, love, and determination. We'll hear from BYU basketball standout Jeff Chapman, who broke barriers at BYU and forever changed his life with the decision to come to Provo. But first, we begin with University of Cincinnati alum and NBA Hall of Famer Oscar Robertson, who put the Bearcats on the map with national relevance, all while handling racial obstacles with dignity and class.
Basketball's most talked about sophomore sensation since Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain is Oscar Robertson of the University of Cincinnati. There's the tap off, and Robertson, number 12, brings the ball down court. Although outstanding as a scorer, he's a team player too.
People ask me a lot of times, how was it to play with Oscar? And that's the question, but I just tell him he's the only one that has a statue over there.
I think he was more than a good player. I think he was a good captain and a good influence on other players on, look, if we're going to be great and we're going to be good, these are the things that we have to do.
In practice, I would catch myself watching him instead of doing what I'm supposed to. He was fascinating to watch.
I loved the guy. He was a superhuman being.
So, of course, he's an NBA champion with the Milwaukee Bucks, 12-time NBA All-Star, Rookie of the Year, and Most Valuable Player. If there was a three-point line during that time, he would average at least 45 points a game. But he was so much more, because if it were not for Oscar Robertson and the Oscar Robertson rule, these guys wouldn't make the money they make. Free agency would not be what it is, not just for pro basketball, but for sports in particular.
One of the all-time greats, there's no doubt about it.
My background started in Charlotte, Tennessee, on a little farm. You know, I was starting to play basketball. I had an older brother that was playing basketball. And my mother called me in the house and said, I got something for you. She gave me a basketball. I just looked at her, I said, thank you, and I hugged her. I was so happy, it was unbelievable. Because nobody had a basketball around there.
I believe that basketball was spiritual, because it was a gift in the present during that time that she knew would make a better future, and she knew it was going to change the future when she gave him that ball.
I think his upbringing and his humble beginnings, I think those things helped shape everything he did. And I think that if you trust yourself and believe in yourself, even if you doubt yourself sometimes, but if you have that underlying faith in yourself, then I think you can persevere through anything.
I went to University of Cincinnati. I didn't know much about recruiting. There was nothing said to us at Crispus Attucks High School. I got some letters from Johnny Wooden in UCLA. Went to Cincinnati because I wanted to get a business degree. I had a few problems, of course, playing in those times.
Oh, it was a challenging time for him. We played down the Dixie Classic, and that was a terrible place to play at that time. I mean, they didn't like black people, and Oscar took a lot of abuse in that game.
I did get some threats over the telephone once in a high school before we played a certain game in the city tournament. I got threats when I was in college before I went down and played in North Carolina. I got letters about this, that they were going to shoot me and do all these things.
There was another time when we went to the University of Houston, and the team stayed at the Shamrock Hilton, actually, and they wouldn't let him stay there.
You just can't have that, you know. We're a team, and everybody that's on this team is going to be treated the same way and dealt with the same way. And I think he was a big factor in the transition from what it was before. He was a leader in changing the attitudes towards a lot of people about you know, hey, we're all in a great game of basketball together, and we're all one team. Let's do it together.
He and my dad are really good friends. My dad has a similar attitude about character, and, you know, they believe in doing the right thing, but they also believe in fighting for change, and that's what he represents. I felt like he inspired me to be a change agent as well.
There were many guys like me who went to schools, first black to play or did all, they called hell too. But more than anything, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I got a good degree. Met my wife there, which was probably the best reason I went to Cincinnati, to be honest.
She played the role of my father's confidant throughout everything in his life. She has a calming spirit to everything. So when everyone else is, you know, a super type A, she's the one who's the calm one who, you know, can speak to you quietly and you'll listen to her.
My dad told me some stories and he said it was something different about him as a leader, number one, but as someone that was inspirational, number two.
Well, I think he did by example more than anything else. You know, he wasn't that vocal.
You know, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one. You know, and we don't talk about church a lot, but what we do talk about is relationship. And I know he has to have a strong relationship with Christ because it shows through his character. And he's always been a man of great character and faith.
I think when his children were going through certain things, you know, after it was all over, you know, he would say that, you know, he prayed for us. He doesn't say that he was going to, but he told us afterwards. Because, you know, he believed and he wanted a situation to turn out for the best for us. And all of us were, thank you.
You know? I think God is in charge of everything we do. And maybe he's got a plan for all this. I hope he does.
I felt the impact based upon what he's done on the culture of sports and basketball, but also for my people in particular.
He knew there was a big responsibility and he just handled it like that's what he was supposed to do.
The ceremony on the Monument Circle when he was in high school, that was a tradition for people who won the state championship. So they had a celebration maybe 40 years later. He was more worried about whether everyone else was included from his team than him. He cares about other people tremendously. And I think that showed when he played on the court, as well as how he lived his life and how he treated his friends.
We were playing a game. I was running down the floor, made a fast break, and Oscar had scored. And he comes over and shakes hands with me. And I don't know why he's shaking hands. Find out that was his 2,500th point that year, or something like that. Maybe 3,000th, I don't know. He was saying thank you for making the pass, yeah, setting him up. Always a gentleman, always was thankful for things that were there. And everything he did, he handled with dignity.
You've got that type of belief system in you. It doesn't matter who you meet or where you go, because you'll always know that you'll end up doing the right thing for yourself and for others. And I think that's something that he's held with him for his entire life and still acts like that.
The Player of the Century Award was very important. And even though Michael Jordan was in that era, you know, they named Oscar Player of the Century. Jerry West was very good friends with Oscar. So they asked him, hey, what's it like being the logo and being the greatest basketball player? And he said, you need to ask Oscar Robertson. He's the greatest. So that should tell you when other players say that you're great.
He's one of a kind, though. Once in a lifetime, you have a player like that, and we were fortunate enough to have him.
And if he cares about you, he's going to care about you through everything. It doesn't matter what you do, but he's going to care about you and try to help you, regardless of your situation.
But you need some angels around you sometimes, some people who are involved in a situation and say, hey, by the way, this, can I help you? If you got it, you got it, something that you want to do, try it. Do as much as you can and try to get that accomplished. And I would say they never give up.
So this is the high school I went to. It was established back in 1934. I graduated in 1984. I remember the post office being right out here, and this is where we went in. Yep, this is my gym. Looks like they have the same rims that I had. Look how old they are.
Even just a smart, you know, bright young man, you know, he always been that.
Jeff's family is amazing. He grew up in a strong Baptist home in Alabama.
The most important thing to my parents was God and Jesus. They were very religious people. We read the Bible together. We went to church together all the time. Playing in this gym, hoping for a Division I scholarship was everything. I can remember coming here as a seventh grader and playing and seeing the varsity guys and saying, one day I'm gonna be one of those varsity guys. And when I finally did my sophomore year become a varsity member, I remember I said, I have to play really well and do really well and become all state so I can get the attention of the big schools in the area. So this is where it all started for me, right here in this gym.
So Jeff was playing at an all-star basketball game, and it happened to be at the same time that the NCAA tournament was going on. So Coach Reed happened to be able to watch the all-star game and saw Jeff play, decided to offer him a scholarship. And so he called Jeff the next week and offered him to come play at BYU.
That building right there is where the band practiced at. The band director, who had never spoken to me in his life, he told me, so you're going to BYU, huh? And I said, yes. And he said, well, let me tell you about Mormons. And he started to lay in the Mormons. And so it was just funny to see how different things were once I got to BYU than what people were saying about it.
BYU in the 80s, so I would say it wasn't quite as hard to get into as it is now, but culturally, LDS and white.
There were only 36 black people on campus in 1984 out of 26,000 students when I got there. I was down south of campus of BYU, and I saw this black kid walking down the road, and I noticed he wasn't an athlete, and the only black people I knew at BYU were athletes. So I said, I'm gonna talk to this guy. So I pulled him over and I asked him, you're not an athlete, right? He said, no. And I asked, well, what are you doing here? And he said, you know, I just got home from my mission. And I was shocked. We ended up becoming roommates and became, you know, long lasting friends after that.
He did not want to join the church. He said he was staying his Southern Baptist religion. People would invite him over and then have the missionaries and things like that. And he always thought that was kind of funny, but.
Sometimes I did have questions, but I didn't want to ask them because I knew they would see that as interest and probably step up the pace and put, you know, talk to me more, and I didn't want that. So when Cruz and I became roommates, I decided to start asking him questions. But the cool thing he did was he would answer the question and then wouldn't say anything else about it. And I was like, okay, he's not pressuring me. I could just ask him anything. He'll give me an answer. He won't continue to try to get me baptized. It finally got to the point where I told him that I wanted to take the discussions and learn more about the gospel.
So the missionaries came, and he always laughs. He says they had him well covered because they were, first of all, sisters, which was always good. And then one was a basketball player, and then one was from Jamaica.
And they didn't know what to do with me because they said, do you want to get baptized? And I said, no, I believe it's true, but I don't have that conviction in my heart. And then we were reading in the Book of Mormon, and then someone read Ether 27 about being humble. And I remember thinking to myself, instead of me being humble and really want to know if this is true, I wanted to be proven to me that it was true. And I said a little quick prayer to myself. Heavenly Father, I'm humbling myself now. If this church is true, please let me know. And at that moment, the Spirit came down on me so strong that I started to weep, but I was happy. I'll just never forget that experience. I was, you know, content being a Southern Baptist. I'm just blown away how things have turned out. I joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I met you, and
like the Lord put you in the right spot and sent you to BYU.
In so many different ways, Jeff was a trailblazer at BYU. He was here when we were growing at a certain place, and now he gets to walk into a locker room that is so reflective of great people from all over the world. He is a legacy member of this BYU basketball community and how it's grown to encompass the entire world.
I think people seeing me play, they realize, if he can do well there, I can too.
And I think that helped a little.
If you living right and you say you this or that, that's, you know, that's your, I don't disrespect nobody's religion. But long as, you know, I'm proud of him. I don't have to worry about you.
I think he's an amazing person. He's taught me so much. Just has been a great example, and grateful to have been on this journey with him, and know we have a lot more to go, and we'll have trials and joys, and glad that we can do it together.
I look back and all the successes that I have had, and it all started here. I just don't know if I would have been as successful as I am now if I didn't have the love and support of this community and the teachers here and my pastor. So I am just eternally grateful for what it has done for me.
Welcome back to our Deep Blue special in Studio B. We now take this journey to the cornfields of Ames, Iowa, and learn about the legend of Jack Trice, whose legacy and life had such an impact that the stadium bears his name. BYU football's Malik Moore traveled with our crew to learn firsthand just how important Jack Trice is to the community of Iowa State.
What's up, Cougar Nation? It's Malik Moore, and we're at Iowa State University, inside of Jack Trice Stadium, who we will be learning about today and how the city of Ames keeps his legacy alive. Let's go.
On the eve of the first great intercollegiate effort, as if inspired, Jack Trice wrote a statement of his ideals of the game. The statement, written on a crumpled piece of Curtis Hotel stationery, was intended for no eyes but his own.
October 5th, 1923. To whom it may concern.
My thoughts just before the first real college game of my life.
The honor of my race, family, and self are at stake. Everyone is expecting me to do big things. I will.
I will.
I will. My whole body and soul are to be thrown recklessly about on the field tomorrow.
Every time the ball is snapped, we'll be trying to do more than my part.
On all defensive plays, I must break through the opponent's line and stop the play in their territory.
Beware of mass interference.
Fight low with your eyes open and toward the play.
Roadblock the interference.
Watch out for cross bucks
and reverse end runs.
Be on your toes every minute if you expect to make good. Jack.
They hear Jack Trice and they say, oh, the stadium. But they really don't know who he was, what he accomplished during his short life.
Jack came here to get an education. He wasn't here to just play football.
This man was our age, in our exact shoes, but doing something that a lot of us couldn't even imagine and couldn't even fathom doing.
He was a really strong student. He was studying animal husbandry, as it was called at that time.
He wanted to go back and teach ex-slaves how to sharecrop, to learn how to make money doing what they had been doing for free for so long.
But this was the time when people of color could not stay in dorms on campus.
There were still lots of segregation. Many institutions at that time weren't even allowing black students, let alone black athletes.
When I go back to that first president, Adonijah Welch, who said everyone was welcome, at that time there were only 4 universities in the nation that would allow women to come and study at the university, let alone a black man.
Jack Trice was the first African-American athlete here at Iowa State University.
Being the first of anything is a precedence. And some people like it, some people don't. There were letters written to Iowa State of schools in our conference that will remain unnamed that did not want to play Iowa State because Jack was on the team.
So Jack Trice left for all of us truly an incredible commitment.
I will.
I will.
I will.
It was the second game of the season in 1923.
We were playing at University of Minnesota.
Going to that game, sitting on a train from here to Minnesota, but he wasn't in the same car with his teammates. He wasn't in the same car with his coach. He gets there and stays at the Curtis Hotel, a different hotel than where all of his teammates are at.
As if inspired, Jack Trice wrote a statement of his ideals of the game.
And if you read the letter, it's almost eerie because it's like he anticipated that something might have happened during that game.
I will.
I will.
I will.
leather pads on the elbows, leather helmets, leather pads on the knees. That's what you go out there and play with. You play both sides, offense and defense. He's out there, first couple plays of the game, don't want him out there. Bow, hit him, broken collarbone. He didn't give up.
I will.
I will.
I will.
He continued to play in this game. Defense play now. He's on defense. Third quarter, roll block. The offense did not jump over him. The offense trampled him. He has to come out the game eventually. He can't keep going after that.
They looked him over at the hospital in Minneapolis and said he was fit to travel.
Battered, bruised, 8 hours or so back to Ames, Iowa.
On a straw bed.
And ultimately he passed away.
He shouldn't have been on a train. He shouldn't have been cleared by the doctors to go. There was not a thorough check. Autopsy comes back. Broken collarbone apparent. Internal bleeding was the cause of death.
As you can see, here's a display case that they have in the library. So back in the day, it wasn't a lot of people at the school enrolled. And for them to cancel all the classes and have 4,000 people come is actually amazing.
I was waiting to talk to the director of intramurals. He had somebody in his office. So I wandered into the gym and was looking around, and I saw that plaque, and I read it. And I thought, what is this? You know, I never knew nothing of that. Although, and it was the team, by the way, that got the plaque made and put in the state gym, so somebody would know.
50 years later, those people weren't around for that. The people that were in college weren't alive when that happened. They find this plaque, and it's like, who is this? It was forgotten because that was it. It was really no other black athlete of that caliber after Jack.
So I trotted over to the library and started copying clippings and all that. And then I wrote a story which appeared in a campus magazine. At that time, I just thought it was an awfully good story. And not thought that it would sell or anything, but it's a story that needed to be told. He did good things. I thought that might get people going, but it didn't. Now, that was in 1957, so it took about 16 more years for it to resurface.
And so the momentum started growing when, in the 80s, the student body and student government president were interested in renaming the stadium after him. They learned about the story, just like a lot of people are now, and said, wow, that's amazing. He really broke barriers here at the university. We should do something to acknowledge the work that he did and acknowledge his legacy.
There's so many different documents of the student body advocating for this, this stadium name change.
It's petitions, 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 petitions. And then right here, I guess this one, students advocating an ideal. The ISU community endures the name Jack Trice Stadium for its simple dignity and symbolic beauty.
A wave after wave of students picked up the baton or the torch or whatever and pursued it. They, at one time, they hired a plane to fly over the stadium when it was after it was built, but not yet named. They said, "Welcome to Jack Trice Stadium," or that. They had a billboard once that said, "Welcome to Ames, home of Jack Trice Stadium."
The students did what they had to do to get Jack recognized.
Jack Trice's legacy wall. You got the infamous letter from Jack Trice. I like how they have the petition here. That shows how all this even started. And you got the famous I will quote, resembling dedication, determination, resiliency, all from him right here.
I've probably never been prouder of Iowa State students as I am with what they did. Stayed with it. They saw a good thing, an important thing, and they made it happen.
As an African-American male, knowing that there's so many different types of stories like this of sacrifice and being the first to do something or being different in a, you know, maybe a field that may not be as understanding or welcoming for you, but, you know, not ever losing the resolve to keep pushing.
We have a long way to go, This whole process saying it took over 50 years, but it happened, shows that we can do anything if we come together. And not that black people weren't, there wasn't enough black people here. It wasn't a lot of black people at Iowa State. So that's why we talk about the white students that did it. There were black students in there as well. If there would have been more black students at Iowa State, they would have been in there as well. But you look at the group that what was predominantly at Iowa, gotta give tip your hat to them. When they came and realized that we are all on the same team, no matter the color of our skin, we are all cyclones. We are all bleeding this cardinal in gold. We are the same. Let's recognize one of our fallen brothers. That's what I think when I think about that group of individuals doing that.
We can't just sit back and say, well, we've done that with Jack Trice now, you know, let's get on with whatever else we're doing. But it's a really good reminder. There's more work to be done.
I will.
I will.
I will.
While his life may have ended short and ended in an untimely death, the story still rings true about who we are as a community.
The significance of having the only stadium in Division I football, 144 some odd schools, named after a black person, for Iowa State to have that story makes it very significant to be here, to feel the atmosphere that you feel when it's a game time. Right now, it's nobody in here but us. But during a game time, the spirit of Jack just resonates in here.
He was only a Negro boy in an agricultural college, but he left a message that will not be forgotten while determination endures. All he did was his best. His record stands squarely behind the assertion that if he were alive today, he could say truthfully, I have fought the good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith.
What a story. Jack Trice's legacy lives on in full force, and he will forever be a beacon of hope and inspiration to all. We'll be back with more stories on Deep Blue after this. Welcome back to our Juneteenth Deep Blue special on BYU Sports Nation. We continue with Mike Hall, who traversed from being a BYU basketball star to fatherhood and to the role of a mentor. His path, winding, included overcoming a tragic loss, which allowed him to bring love to those around him. This is Deep Blue.
I had a great dunk and ended up being ESPN Player of the Week.
He still lives off of that moment. It was exciting.
But what people don't know about that game is that I had 3 points. I had that dunk and a free throw. That's all I had. I just had 3 points. I fouled out that game, and I actually airballed a free throw. It was like 3 feet short, but it was a game that I remember.
He had kind of a rough road to BYU.
Right out of high school, my girlfriend and I, we ended up having a child, and that's right before I started my freshman year at Pepperdine.
He went to school because he had to in order to be able to play basketball with the hopes of a college scholarship.
Ended up getting kicked out of Pepperdine because I just wasn't taking care of my business. The maturity, I wasn't there.
He will tell you he was not the best student. He didn't take his schooling very seriously. I think he always kind of knew basketball is going to be my thing. And so school, meh, you know, whatever.
Coach at Pepperdine, he helped me come to get to Utah. He sent me to Dixie and said, hey, Mike, okay, go here. Get away from home. Get away from L.A. Get away from that scene. You can go concentrate, play basketball, get your grades back together.
Coach Rose has ties with Dixie, and he ended up here at BYU.
I don't think Mike Hall ever grew up thinking, man, someday I'm going to go to BYU and be a BYU Cougar. In fact, I'll bet you he didn't even know anything about BYU until somebody said, hey, would you like to come play basketball at Brigham Young University? And I love that about him because he brings just a different perspective. He came to Brigham Young University to be a basketball player. I think he left Brigham Young University prepared to be an excellent husband, father, and contributor to the community.
I had grown up a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, knew that I wanted to be married in the temple, and my high school boyfriend was not a member of the church, and that was one of the reasons why we broke up. Then, of course, I meet Mike, who's not a member of the church, and I'm like, oh, but he's so fun.
I told her friend, I was like, I think I got a crush on her.
I think it got obviously to the point where we both cared a lot for each other. And we realized maybe this is going to go somewhere.
You know, life happens and I end up getting baptized after I left BYU. And, you know, she stuck around. She stuck around. And then a year later, we got married in Temple. So it's a long process. And then, you know, life happens, start our family. And here we are 16 years later.
When we got married, I knew that I wanted four kids. I'm kind of a control freak. We started our family right away, and then all of a sudden, our youngest is getting ready to go into first grade. And in July, I kind of felt like maybe I was pregnant.
JoJo, our baby girl, she was born in March of 2021.
Within 3 seconds of her getting here, she wasn't breathing.
She had breathing tube, feed into everything you had, you know.
For some, it would be too much to handle, but for Tara and Mike, who, you know, are so willing to just get to work and find a way to get things done, they really embraced it.
We didn't know that she had anything. No ultrasounds gave us any hints that anything was going to be wrong with this baby.
She had a rare genetic disease called cat eye syndrome, which kind of affected a lot of things in her body. Some of the stuff I still don't really understand.
Joe was in and out of the hospital for her whole life. She was being suctioned because she couldn't swallow. She was on oxygen off and on quite a bit.
One night, she just kind of turned pale blue. And that was the last night she...
Mike came, met me at the emergency room, and I think by the time he got there, they were doing CPR on our baby. And that was crazy. To see doctors doing chest compressions on your little infant in the ER room, and we just hugged each other and watched and listened to them. Because she was so in and out of the hospital, we never got to give her a name or a blessing. And so we called our bishop and asked him if Mike could give her a blessing and give her name. And so we did that together. And we just rocked her. And we're able to say goodbye to her just real peacefully. It was beautiful.
Joe taught us how to love outside ourselves and not think about ourselves.
It was inspiring to see how it united the family, how they came together and worked through it together and relied on their testimonies of families being together forever to really get them through it.
Around her birthday, because birthdays, those kind of days can be hard, but in March, we try and look around even our everyday situations. What can we do to maybe bring a little joy to their life? Because Jordan brought us joy. So our joy for JoJo is what we look forward to in March, to looking around ourselves, to looking outside of ourselves and giving back.
As soon as the Big 12 announcement happened, you know, Kalani felt a strong sense of need to evaluate all areas.
We opened that spot to have somebody be a true mentor that where it doesn't involve playing time. The players need a place to go that's not just about the field.
There was a lot of things that Mike brought to the table in terms of just his life experience.
His ups and his downs, both with basketball, in trying to make sports his career, with family, with even different career changes and different roles. I think he's in a great role to be a mentor.
I try to be myself. I think working with athletes, and especially college athletes, these athletes, they get a lot of people to tell them yes all the time, right? That's not my job. My job when I was a basketball and my job now is to tell these guys what they need to hear.
I think he puts all that together and gives these guys a game plan and a vision of what they can accomplish and gives them things to think about that they never thought was possible.
When I ask our guys how they're doing, I mean it. Like, how are you doing? How can I help? That's one thing that I've learned through Joe's. It's like, how are you guys doing, man? Because our hearts are different. And I want to help you with that if I can.
Mike Hall continues to inspire BYU athletes and all who come in contact with him. What an inspiration. Still on the way, a fan favorite defensive back and a barrier breaking quarterback. You're watching our Juneteenth special of Deep Blue on BYU TV. Great to have you with us on this Juneteenth special of Deep Blue on BYU TV. The game of football was a way out for BYU defensive back Eddie Heckard. It gave him a path to escape from tragedy and to escape to a much better life. This is Deep Blue.
I had pictures for football that day.
Little Eddie went to get his hair cut.
We stayed right across the street from like a shopping plaza. I could just walk across the street.
An area in which I begged and pleaded with my brother not to go back to.
I remember my dad, he gave me the money, got my hair cut. Then as I'm coming back home, I see one of my dad's closest friends like running towards me and his hand was bleeding or whatever. Then he's like, somebody got your dad tied up and they robbing him.
Eddie was born in the North Las Vegas Hospital. At the time, his mom was incarcerated.
My dad was in prison or whatever.
I picked him up from the hospital. But that was already the plan that his parents had put into place. So I got the call.
You know, she did the best she could. Obviously, when my brother came home, Eddie was his first, you know, first order of business. And, you know, he got him back with him. And it was beautiful to see. He raised him right. He directed him and he guided him right. Regardless as to what else was going on, you know, he made sure he stayed on track.
And he put me in track and I was playing football right away.
I think I met Eddie in like 06. I ran into his father. He knew about the program we were building. Said that he was a really good player. And we brought him out. And from the first day, man, one of the best kids I've ever coached. Right out here, man, he's won like 4 or 5 championships right on this field. And just kept going.
I excelled in football pretty fast. I don't know like how or from what. Like I was always a good tackler. My dad was like pushing me as well, but it was just like more of a reward behind it. Every time I mess up, like I give him $1. Anytime I get it right, he'd give me back money.
It was a father and son bond right there, and it was awesome to see.
Once he committed his life to like staying out of jail and stuff, he did. He was a good dad in my eyes.
But back then, we only have probably like 3 fathers active. Ed was one, and like I say, he was trying to do right, you know, by his boy and trying to bring him up the right way. He was doing the best he can do, and he was doing a great job, you know, and it was just sad to see, you know, it all come to an end like that.
Somebody got your dad tied up and they robbing him.
I seen, I think the first officer that arrived, he started bringing out the yellow tape. I was like, whoa. And at the same moment, Eddie come running across the parking lot.
The fire department wasn't able to gain entry into the house because it was an older house, and with that kind of security gate they couldn't get in. And here's little Eddie walking through the crowd. I didn't even see him. He walked up to the fire people and said, will this help? And he gave them his door key in order to get in the house.
The officer asked me who I was. I told him I was his coach. We had practice, so I just put Eddie in the car. I still didn't know what was going on at the moment. And we just took off, you know, to get away from what was going on and kind of have some ideas, you know. That ride to practice, man, you know, looking in the rearview mirror at the kid, he was back there, man, tears, and he was confused. He didn't know what was going on, you know. He was scared, and I was scared for him.
We grew up out of the crack era. We come from the crack era. So basically, it was a situation where he was selling crack. Once little Eddie was born, once he got out of jail, he never used crack no more. So, but he was hustling.
You know, he was in his home, let people in that he was acquainted with.
And they jumped him, you know, roughed him up, blunt force trauma. They was gonna try to rob him. My brother wasn't gonna give him it. He wasn't gonna give him whatever they was asking for. You know, he could have probably just gave it to him and been alive, but that's not how we built.
And they killed him. And they tried to burn the house down in order to cover up evidence, but it didn't work.
If I would have just walked straight home, I probably would have walked into it or something. And I think about that sometimes. It's just, it's the way God handles things. And everything happens for a reason. So I feel like that's the reason.
I'm sure he had some mourning days, but no, we wasn't going to let him sit in the corner and just, you know, soak in it. You know, we kept loving him, man. Just, let's keep playing. Let's just, you know, your dad watching you, man. Let's go have this game for your dad today. You know, let's go keep doing it. Let's just keep going.
Uncle Kyle and Marissa was there for him through everything. Like, they was at the graduations, at every game, making a way, just making sure that he was happy as much as they can. So I know they probably couldn't get him everything, but he didn't know that probably. Like, they made a way for him. And still, like, he look up to them.
The chain has been broken. The chain was broken when he got his scholarship. The chain was broken when he entered into college. The chain was broken when he graduated.
The injuries in college, just the ascent that he had, you know, being a partial scholarship guy to a full scholarship guy to an All-American, it wasn't easy. And it didn't come easy at any stage. And the greatest compliment I can give him is he's very resilient and he's done things the right way.
Even though you come from like a poverty neighborhood or hood with a lot of violence, like, you can make it out. Like, you don't have to just be stuck in it and do what everybody else doing and going down the wrong path. Like you can make it out. Like, now you got the kids down the street like, oh, I want to be like Eddie. Like, go to college. Go be great. Go let everybody all come together and watch you play.
That's what breaking the chains is to me. Like, just changing that name for ourselves, starting a new generation of another lifestyle.
I believe by faith God has not brought him this far to not fulfill whatever Eddie's heart's desires are and whatever my prayers have been for him. You know, I live like that, and I'm going to keep on pushing it. I'm going to keep on pushing that through my mind, putting it in the universe, and, you know, and instilling whatever I can in him to keep him encouraged.
I know he definitely making his dad proud. I don't even know if he know he making his dad proud, but if we proud of him, his dad for sure proud of him.
Good job, Eddie. Way to go.
Our Deep Blue special continues, and we do so with a quarterback. We've gotten to know a few historic quarterbacks at BYU over the years, and Jaron Hall, rather recently, added his name to that great legacy of Cougars. Hall made history at BYU, becoming the first black starting quarterback in program history. He dealt with multiple concussions in the 2019 season, overcame injuries, and eventually went on to play and get drafted into the NFL. This is Deep Blue.
Don't let other people define who you are. Don't let other people justify who you are. Allow your actions to speak in volumes. Allow the things and the merits of who you are as a man and as a young woman to define who you are. Do not allow others to classify you, even though we are proud of the heritage that we have. We're proud to be who we are, but we're not going to allow someone else to tell us who we are.
What does it mean for you to be the first black American starting quarterback here at BYU?
I'm very proud of, you know, my ancestors, very proud of my ethnicity and, you know, all the things that come with that. So it's an honor and a privilege to be here and to be, you know, playing at this wonderful university.
As you talk more about, you know, the significance of it, however, you know, being the first black quarterback at BYU and just the, you know, what surrounds that, you know, BYU and its history of, you know, the individuals it brings in, but it also kind of puts more emphasis on my need to be a better person every day because, you know, I will, in a sense, always be remembered for that. And so it's just a good reminder to keep on the track that I'm on and just keep doing the things I'm doing.
He's a very accurate thrower. He's got flawless mechanics. Just a really true, smooth throwing motion that you can't teach that. He's got it. So he's a true quarterback for sure. And he's a good athlete, but he's a quarterback that happens to be a good athlete.
Motion, keeper for Hall, following his blockers. Nicely done. 25-20, 15-10, makes a sidestep, makes a man miss, gets into the end zone, touchdown run, Jaron Hall!
The fact that he can play a lot of different positions is really important, but I think he thrives the most at quarterback. It also doesn't limit him that he can play a lot of different sports. You know, he's a multi-sport athlete. I'm pretty sure he can play more than just baseball and football, but the athleticism, the skill that it takes to be able to do so many different things and do it well with not as much practice as everyone else has, I think it's a remarkable thing that he's done, and a huge credit to the way that he was raised by his mom and dad.
Hall claps the hands, takes a drop, takes off on the quarterback draw, navigates his way into the end zone! Riley Nelson calls it! Jaren Hall executes it!
We didn't necessarily expect to see Baylor Romney after that first half for Hall. We thought we might see him earlier in the game, but after that showing, a surprise here.
Jaren Hall, who started tonight for BYU at quarterback, will not return to this ballgame, according to BYU.
So they haven't told us what the injury is, but looking at that last play, he dove into the end zone, landing on his shoulder and his head. And remember, he was out, missed the last game because of a concussion. So what would worry me, concern me, is that he has a similar issue because of the way he landed in the end zone.
Right after it happened, I came off the sideline, I sat down, I felt fine, then all of a sudden just kind of went drifting off into la-la land. You know, I had no idea where I was.
He played in a lot of football games and took a lot of hits and hadn't had concussions.
Those hurt. You don't feel that one in the morning.
To have two of them in the time frame that he had them in, I think caught everybody by surprise.
You know, a lot of emotions come when you're concussed. I wouldn't say I'm the most emotional individual, but I kind of broke down a little bit, was kind of frustrated and kind of confused for why it would happen again, you know, after such a fun half of football. You know, it was the most fun I'd had really all my life playing football at that level in that stadium. So I was just really frustrated and confused, felt like I'd done all the right things. Just one of those stories, right? You just kind of feel bad for yourself. And then as my dad came in, you know, he was kind of frustrated too, being the supportive father he is. He laid his hands on my head. They gave me a father's blessing just for comfort, and it just kind of reminded me of what's most important, that the Lord, you know, he had me, you know, under his wing right then. He knew what was happening, and it was happening for a reason, and just kind of got over at that point, felt much better, went back on the sideline, and just told myself I'm here for the team now, and I'll do what I can until I get healthy, and it was a good lesson for me.
I think it's difficult. You know, injury is always a hard thing to come back from, and sometimes it becomes a lonely world, you know, and everything else seems to keep moving. I've been there before, but I thought he's handled it really well. From our perspective, we have to be careful, because I think he's the kind that just wants to go gung-ho the entire time, doesn't want to hold anything back. I think that being able to see the strength and the resolve that he has in himself as a person to respond back from the injuries, but you know, it takes another thing to do that individually, but to do it and then help others along the way, that's an awesome thing to do as a teammate and as a player.
Football has really just given me everything I have so far. It's given me a lot of confidence and hope in my future. And so I thank, you know, the Lord every day that I have the opportunity to play and just be a kid. And every day, football just reminds me to be a kid and to have fun.
Jaren Hall's legacy will forever remain in Provo. And he has opened the door for future athletes to come and chase their own unique dreams. As we close out, another reminder to watch more inspirational stories just like the ones we saw and heard tonight by visiting byutv.org/deepblue. Our thanks again to Oscar Robertson, Jeff Chapman, Malik Moore, the community of Ames, Iowa, Mike Hall, Eddie Heckard, and Jaren Hall for sharing their unique, incredible stories. And thank you for joining us on this Juneteenth Deep Blue special. For every member of our outstanding crew here at BYU TV, I'm Spencer Linton. We'll see you next time.